Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and still practices on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a five-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com to learn more about the show or download a free prescription for naloxone. Carrying naloxone for drugs is like carrying an EpiPen for allergies. Today's episode is sponsored by Families Against Fentanyl. FAF is an organization set on attacking the supply chain of deadly illicit fentanyl. To learn more, visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org and sign their petition to declare illicit fentanyl a weapon of mass destruction. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an EMS conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. EMS is Emergency Medical Systems. Think 911 and ambulances. As an emergency physician, I treat anything that comes in our doors by EMS or walk-in, and what hits our doors bears witness to the challenges of our society. They say all the world is a stage and the people in the emergency department have the front seat. And the stage today in California's emergency medical systems is the trifecta of homelessness, mental health, and drugs. The CDC mortality report on drug overdoses shows us over 105,000 deaths in the past year. All preventable, potentially preventable, a crazy number. But what about the saves, the people who almost died but were saved with naloxone? That number is even greater. We have that. The National Highway Traffic Safety Administration, NHTSA, has the data from participating EMS agencies. And between February 2023 and February 2024, they recorded 500,000, over 500,000 non-fatal overdoses. 43.6% received naloxone, life-saving opioid reversal agent, and 21.7% refused transportation to the hospital at all. Our ambulances, EMTs, paramedics treat 500,000 people who almost died of overdoses. That sounds like a tremendous opportunity for intervention. To learn more about EMS, I reach out to Dr. Gerard Carroll. Dr. Gerard Carroll is a fellow emergency physician like me, also board certified in addiction medicine like me, but Dr. Carroll has expertise I don't have. He went one further and is triple boarded and also specializes in EMS, emergency medical services. He is the medical director of the EMS system of Cooper University, Camden, New Jersey. Dr. Cooper is not satisfied with the status quo and looks out of the box for solutions to many problems, including drugs and addiction. To learn more about Dr. Gerard Carroll, check out the High Truth show notes. Dr. Gerard Carroll, welcome to High Truths.
Thanks for having me.
It is always fun for me to have a fellow emergency physician on. We're similar. We both practice on the front lines in the emergency department. We're both board certified in addiction medicine, but you got one more in EMS. And so how is that all connected for you? Emergency medicine, EMS, addiction?
So I took that kind of roundabout way into medicine. I went to college to go to think about law school, was a history major, and got into EMS while I was in college and fell in love with it there, became a paramedic, worked in New York City for almost a decade, responded to 9/11, kind of really got into the street part of it. And then in 2005, went back, did med school, did residency in emergency medicine. And then when I graduated, I took an academic position at Cooper University Hospital in Camden, New Jersey, did an EMS fellowship, became an EMS physician, kind of tying those two pieces of my life back together, being able to practice both in the emergency department and directly in the field, doing medical direction and also field response. And then in the last 5 years, when the addiction crisis kind of really hit us even harder than it had before, I kind of ended up exploring the whole new world, which was kind of never something I had considered, was addiction medicine. And I grandfathered into that and took my boards, I guess, a year or two ago. And so now I'm triple boarded, kind of this crazy, strange process. We'll see what I cross myself into next. I'm always looking for what's going to happen. You know, what do I got to do next?
Yeah, forensics. You can. There's a board in that. You could do another quadruple boarded.
That might kill me. Hopefully just three. But.
You kind of glanced on that, but I think it's a really important. There's a monumental event that happened in your life, but also in the life of our country in New York. You were there in the morning of 9/11. What were you doing, and how did that experience change you?
Yeah, I think it probably kicked me in the butt. I worked Midtown Manhattan for the majority of my EMS career. So, you know, I pulled up right after the first plane hit. We kind of did the normal crazy shuffle for hours. Both buildings collapsed while we were there. It was kind of crazy. We were on the west side of the building, which was a little bit safer, thank God. But yeah, it was definitely one of those formative times in your life, you know. Kind of been coasting, being working 3 days a week as a paramedic in New York City and running around. It's a great way to spend your 20s. I really loved it. And I was trying to decide, did I want to do the next steps as a paramedic? Did I want to go into education? Did I want to go into leadership? Or did I want to try a different field? And one of the problems, which we can talk about in EMS, is that there aren't a ton of career trajectories, and that's still true today, which is a problem for the business. And so at that point, I kind of went back to school. You know, faced physics and calculus, which I hadn't been as excited about, and you know, did the pre-med thing and then went to medical school up at Dartmouth.
Yeah, so that it was a monumental event. Yeah, and it changed you. It shaped who and what you do right now. They say that all the world is a stage, and people in the emergency department have the front seat, and the MS also. So, and I say, if you ever want to see what's wrong with society, just visit an emergency department. First of all, do you think that that's true? And if so, what do you see? What's our problems?
Well, we don't only have an hour to talk, but I mean, you absolutely get a right. You get a front seat. And EMS is even, it's kind of behind stage. It's even worse than the front seat in a lot of ways, right? You're in people's homes. I mean, and to be fair, you see everyone at their worst in EM and EMS. And so you take that, you know, you can't get too jaded. But I've always worked in kind of inner city, often really deprived neighborhoods with lots of social challenges. And you can see it in the city. I work in Camden, New Jersey, one of the poorest cities in the nation. You know, and day to day, I see people struggling to make ends meet, housing insecurity, lack of jobs, skilled jobs, then all of the healthcare challenges and actually putting it together. And then what kind of led me to this new world of addiction medicine we're going to talk about today is that 5 years ago, 6 years ago, like things changed in Camden. And I've been there over 12 years now. And we certainly had overdoses. There were plenty of people with substance use disorders. But like the wheels came off the ambulance in like 2018 for us. Our EMS usually does shortness of breath and chest pain as their call types. Not that dissimilar from the emergency department. I had some abdominal pain. But all of a sudden, if you look at the track board in the ED and if you look at the call types coming out, it was all unconscious and overdose. We gave 13% of the Narcan in New Jersey that year in Camden. And so we were just, it was just this new world we couldn't figure out. My providers were burning out, my colleagues, myself, we were all having that compassion fatigue. You know, you'd go to one overdose, you'd know them, you'd counsel them or talk to them if you could. And then the next time you wouldn't get there in time and you'd be someone 30 in cardiac arrest. And our cardiac arrest rate kept going down that year. So it was really a big change for us. And so we were really, I think those are the social ills, that front page that we talk about. You could go into so many different things that we see and that you see every day. But that's the one that has really kind of shaped the last 5 years of my career.
The big overdose. And I don't know, I would add to that the mental health also. ERs are full of people with mental health crises and no place to put them.
No, it's true. And we have even less to offer them than I do for opiate use disorder or other substance use disorders. Whether it's a mood-induced substance use disorder or, you know, treating that underlying mental health issue, all I can do is tie you up and lock you up in my poor emergency department and hope I can get you resources, which I often can't.
Yeah. It's a huge issue. What interests me is that intersection, and I'm like amazed that nobody has studied this. I'm trying to. Is what percentage of those people who are there for psychosis, depression, suicidal ideation have that substances? And how many of them, you know, I'm sure you see this. We have the drunkicidal patients who are there and they sober up and now they're not suicidal anymore. And we have I don't think you have methamphetamine as much as we do, but we have methicidal also. And after detox or, Even now, it doesn't rhyme as well. Cannabis-acetyl. But we have that too, where you detox from drugs, any drugs, right? Whether it's alcohol, meth, or marijuana, and then, you know, your brain changes.
No, it's true. And we still have a huge PCP problem, which is our kind of, no one ever really has. It seems to be a Philadelphia, New York, New Jersey kind of thing. I'm hoping you keep the meth, but that's the same thing. You come in somewhere dissociated, and often that suicidal kind of substance induced. And then often you do sober and you're better. And that also mixes in with the fact that when you're drunk and you're homeless, a lot of people feel suicidal and those feelings come and go. But it doesn't change, I think. But when you look at our psychiatric patients, the vast majority of them use, you know, illicit substances. And I would say most of them have some kind of substance use disorder. It's just very difficult in the thick of it to actually know, the chicken or the egg kind of phenomena. Is it because of their drug use or did their mental health issue come first?
Right. SAMHSA does publish the data, and you see the big circle of people who have any mental health illness, AMI, they call it, and substance use disorder. But if you look at it backwards, everybody with a substance use disorder, about 50% of them have some type of mental illness. So that intersection is there, and I feel like we see that crossroads right in our emergency department. One of the things in your bio that I really liked is that you said, not satisfied with the status quo. I love that because I'm never satisfied with the status quo. But what do you mean by that? What irks you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, we both work in the emergency department. We both work in addiction medicine, and I work in EMS. And all three career areas are pretty new as things go, right? Surgery's been a lot longer than any of those specialties. And they have lots of things that aren't working correctly. I think EMS is probably where I have the biggest concerns, but just lining it up. So if you think of the practice as EMS as medicine, it still sits under the Department of Transportation. And there's always this kind of pulling. Are we just four wheels to take you somewhere, or are we a healthcare entity? And how is EMS defined that way? I think if you look across the country, EMS is very much a binary, you call, we haul. And almost every 99% of what EMS does really revolves in there. And if you look at what the emergency department is, under siege, we're overwhelmed, we're full. Not always the best place to go. And I think there needs to be a lot more research, both in what EMS can do when they don't transport, but even also when they transport somewhere else. And other countries have really explored this in different ways, and different parts of the country are as well. But we're one country, but we're also 50 countries, depending on what you're doing. And in EMS, we're definitely 50 or more countries because everyone's doing it just a little differently.
And 50 within each state, too, 50.
Yeah, exactly. Each county is this city has it this way, right? We give buprenorphine on our trucks, but this town next to us certainly does not. No, I agree. So I think if I were to line up, so we don't get too far afield, just in EMS, I think if we start to look at that binary relationship with paramedics and EMTs come and they take you somewhere, I think we need to start investing and focusing on what they can do while they're there and what they can prevent. Lots of part of the country, especially in rural areas, EMS services do a lot lower call volume, and they're often just around. How can we use them? It's not, if you talk to a paramedic or an EMT, they know when they pick up someone who fell and broke their hip, very often one of them's been there recently for some other issue and knew that there was no hand, there was no shower handle. Fire departments have done some of this, right? You couldn't walk safely in that apartment. There's just lots of things and holes in our society, especially as the population is getting older, that we could redirect these resources to help with. And then obviously we always talk about, and some places are doing this now, and I can't wait, New Jersey is just on the cusp of allowing this, where, I see you for your overdose today, and right now that ends the EMS interaction with you. But if you're homeless, I may be the only person who knows where you stay, right? I can try and get you in a clinic, but you don't have transport. Lots of things have fallen apart in your life. We could go visit you the next day and we could bring you your medication. We could bridge you for a few days while we figure out the next steps. There's all those kinds of possibilities, I think, that EMS. So that's that status quo that I'm not satisfied there.
So what are some of the solutions? So you mentioned some things, like you said, leaving behind naloxone. What are some of the programs? And we were kind of talking before. What are the programs that are now standard of care, that you would consider at least standard of care for EMS? And and where do we kind of need to go with that?
Yeah, so that's a great question. So I think 5 years ago, standard of care in most places, and unfortunately many places today, was that your ambulance carried naloxone, that the average amount of education that an EMT or paramedic had gotten was really just about overdose reversal and not so much about substance use disorders or the fact that it was a medical, not a moral failing, medical disease, not a moral failing. I think today there's a menu of things that your services can do, and I think some of them should be considered a standard of care, and then I think some are moving in that direction. But I think if you're just resuscitating people with naloxone after they overdose, or worse, if your BLS aren't even carrying naloxone, you're way behind the times and we have to catch up.
Get with the program, folks, right?
Yeah, exactly. I always hate when I talk to my colleagues who say, well, that's not a problem where we live. It absolutely is a problem everywhere you live.
Like 100, this is the problem. this is the public health crisy crisis now. It's not COVID. Right? The number one cause of death ages 18 to 45, even during COVID, was fentanyl.
No, I mean, it all got worse for my patients during during COVID. And COVID was a challenge. I'm not going to try and take away from the stress of that. But so I think if I thought of it as a menu, right? So, you know, the simplest menu, you carry Narcan and you help people breathe when they overdose. I think leaving behind Narcan after that overdose or even on your other cases is also now standard of care. Lots of the country is doing this, but there are still places that are refusing to or that do it and don't do it. And I think it's time to really reinforce that. And then the third thing I think that needs to happen is the education. I don't know what your substance use disorder background was, but for me, it was pretty sparse, both in certainly in my paramedic program, my EMT program, but even in medical school, it wasn't a huge focus. I certainly was more as there was more of everything. And I found 5 years ago when I got into the space and started reading and learning about it, that I had filled in a lot of those blanks with my childhood and growing up in the Hallmark Channel, for God's sake. You know, where do you put those things? You know, how much of that hidden curriculum had affected me, or these patients didn't necessarily deserve the same level of care. They always joke in EMS, there used to be a Narcan protocol based on what floor you were on, right? Because you more in withdrawal, the better you walked out, which is kind of a horrible thought, right? And all of those kinds of things that I just accepted as part of that hidden curriculum for years, you have to start thinking about. So I think it's a long way of saying that third piece of what needs to be part of the standard of care.
In fairness to our colleagues in previous generation, we didn't have the tools.
Right. No, absolutely. I think you're not behind 10 years behind the times, but yeah. I think you're 5 or 6 years behind the times if we're not doing it now. And every day we find that we're behind the time in something. It's more about identifying it and facing it, right? I'm sure if you sit and come and look in my backyard of my ER or my EMS service, you'll find something I'm not doing I need to do. And actually, I invite you to come on over. Let's do it. But that third thing is, how are you educating your people? Like, how are you challenging that thought process? Because we can't really engage with this population if we are not actually explaining what the illness really is. And then I think that's kind of the basic menu. If you're not doing any of those, I think you really have to look inside your service and get with it. The second side, I think, are a lot of things that I think you ought to add to, and I think very soon you'll be behind on them too. Lots of places are now having their paramedics carry buprenorphine. While there's no randomized controlled studies on it, we've studied it where I'm doing it. A number of California has jumped in and has a few studies. And there's a lot of experiential knowledge across the country now. I think there's almost 20 states doing it, multiple provinces in Canada. I think it's safe, it's easy, it's well within the medical talent and knowledge of our paramedic skills to do. It's actually it's less about pharmacology and more about like patient engagement and getting your paramedics able to do this. But I think very soon having this on a paramedic truck will just be like having epinephrine, Narcan, Cardizem as kind of just a medication that every paramedic has access to.
Would you consider the whole buprenorphine treatment by EMS, it's not standard of care yet. Is it cutting edge or it's like, no, a lot of people are doing this?
I think you always want to be that guy who was cutting edge. Maybe I was 4 years ago, but I think it's pretty basic. A lot of people can do it. And I think enough people are doing that it's not quite cutting edge anymore. I think, and the outcomes are good enough and the safety data is even better to suggest that this is something we should be doing. And the nice thing about it is usually we ask for people to do expensive things, right? The country is starting to talk about carrying EMS blood, which I'm also a fan of. And the data is starting to come in while we figure that out.
Say that again, cutting EMS what?
Like EMS is starting to carry blood in the pre-hospital arena.
Okay. Like so transfusion, to do transfusion.
And that's, yes, for transfusion. And that's pretty cutting edge. But the data for BUP, I think, is even better than that. And so for everybody who's excited about blood, I think you also need to get excited about BUP. And I'm excited about both. I'm an EMS guy. But like I said, it's just a very safe, easy thing that our people can do. And there's lots of, you don't have to do a lot of work to do it. It's cheap, right? The medication is $5 a strip. We carry medications that are many, many times more expensive. It's just a very easy intervention. So I'm hoping to see that number of states are starting to consider making it formulary and making it required. And so I think when we start to see that, it'll move over onto that other side of things. We're not quite there yet. It's still optional in most places.
Right. And so what are things that are cutting edge in the addiction EMS field?
Yeah, so I think a lot of it has to do with what your partners are. I think cutting edge is partnering and actually doing the social service side of addiction care, going back out multiple days in a row, dosing people, even when they haven't overdosed and they're just in withdrawal for whatever reason, looking into long-term injectables, right? One of the things that we're examining, which we have not started, is whether medications like Brixadi or even Sublocade could be dosed in the field instead of waiting, because there's long wait times to get those in clinic. And could we actually bridge that? You know, we have this huge challenge of what do we do in rural areas where there are no clinics and there's just no services? There's a huge opiate use disorder challenge there. You know, could you overdose? Could I get, you know, could we view you through your withdrawal? And that day or the next day or a few days later, could we give you a week, you know, weekly Brixadi, which gives us that much more time to figure this out? So those are the kind of the cutting edge things I think we need to think about. And the other side of that, which it seems so easy, but harm reduction. I mean, Narcan is harm reduction, education is harm reduction, but actually, you know, I didn't always feel this way, but the way I feel about it now is harm reduction is all about keeping people alive until they're ready to go to recovery. And that could be a week, that could be a month, that could be never, but our job is to keep them alive in the hope that they will. And so that's, you know, paramedics, and almost no one does this. Can they handing out syringes, handing out needles, condoms, even just toiletries and things for people who are, you know, undomiciled and just have housing insecurity, all those things that make their lives, you know, a little bit safer. And so I think that's pretty cutting edge. Pretty
you're difficult. Making me think now.
Yeah.
Because if you feel that the role of EMS, and we definitely, I mean, again, we just see all the problems of society, and our job is to keep people alive. That's our thing. But I also think, you could test my theory, but that because we see these problems, whatever it is, whether it's a heart attack or a car accident or motorcycle or scooters that are accidents that are happening, you know, we have now, or in San Diego, it's border falls, then we also, we could splint the ankles and fix, you know, for people falling down, or we could think prevention. I always feel like you have a bigger fix if you think of prevention, right? So you're thinking, oh, well, paramedics need to do more harm reduction. We need to like give away needles or things like that. And I'm thinking, well, if you see such a role for EMS, then maybe I'd want you to think upstream instead of downstream with prevention, because what I look at the big picture, we're spending billions and billions and billions more each year on the issue of drugs, but we're not getting the results. And why are we not getting the results? And I feel like because we're not spending that proportionately. We're spending it on the 7% of the population that we need to keep alive, our patients, okay? But we're spending all that money on that instead of spending it on the 300 million Americans who have a potential of becoming that 7%. And that was a formula with tobacco, with, frankly, the opioid prescription epidemic. Our goal was to, we had the patients who were like on a bucket of medications. We just needed to keep them alive. We weren't going to take all those meds away from them. And then we had the next generation of Americans. We were not going to put you on opioids for every, you know, little headache or back pain that you have. And so that upstream prevention is how we solve the problem. But I went through this whole ordeal here with you just to get you thinking, because you like to don't like the status quo and thinking big things for EMS. I'm thinking you see all societies. So you can, you know, say, well, good job not using drugs to the 7-year-old that you pick up or whatever little, there's a lot that can be done with small words of encouragement. And there are experts on that. But I'd like to see, if you're thinking big and different like that, I'd like to see you get into the prevention space.
I mean, prevention is awesome. I mean, I'm that guy who wants everyone in their neighborhood to wear a helmet and yells at you when you try and play with whatever
new
gun doesn't have eye protection. So I hear you. They definitely have that ER doc problem. It always troubles me. We've talked about this before, like over beers or over a journal club. Like, how do you get into that space, right? I agree, right? That 300 million who aren't using, how do we keep them from using, right? And as an emergency provider, that's never my first goal. I'm always thinking about how to put you back together. It's hard to put, like, you know, police departments, fire departments have some of these roles in the outreach world, part of the kind of things in schools. Might be a sad thing, like EMS is a little bit under fire and they don't always have those kinds of resources to move beyond the emergency side of things. But I mean, there's no reason they couldn't take leadership there. It's definitely worth thinking about. I wish I had a lot of ideas off the cuff for that though.
I'll tell you what I do in the ER in a small base, because I think prevention and everything, right? Somebody who fell down, broke her hip. Well, what am I going to do? Let's talk about how you fell for a little bit so we could think about how you won't fall down again, right? So I don't know. I have that prevention focus in individual patients and society. But I mean, as what I learned from this podcast, from other experts who know how to who deal with prevention, and there are actually evidence-based studies, you know, what this school got, this type of resilience life skills, and this school didn't in an inner city area. And how did that, and the people who got this type of education had, you know, less overdose, less violence, less bullying, higher education, et cetera. So we know that science is out there. How does that relate to what we could do in our profession? But again, just like you're thinking, oh, I could give syringes out. You could also say, you know what? Every kid I'm going to see now who makes a choice to protect their brain till 25 and not use drugs, I'm going to give them a little fireman sticker. Like, I don't know. Like,
No, I mean, there's definitely ways to do it. And there's certainly, I mean, community outreach. And there's whether it turns out that opiate use disorder is the best place that EMS can do prevention or not. Like, you talked about, like, the hip
fracture.
It's
not just
like,
opioid, but just any. Yeah, just any drug.
Slips, right? Trips, and falls. Like, literally, I think back with a little guilt about how many people I took out of houses who I knew were just, you know, one or two more bad rugs or trip over a box kind of thing to their next fracture, right? Yeah. You're in those homes. There's a huge benefit for prevention there. We are in the community watching people drive around without their helmets on. And I mean, in Camden, we have these four-wheelers and people on motorbikes driving around without helmets. And not sure what I could do about that, but it's something to think about it, because we take a lot of them with head injuries every year to the hospital.
Yeah.
So I think you're right.
Or what I'm understanding is reward the social norm of people not using drugs, wearing helmets or whatever, you know, things like that. I don't know. Just something to thought. But I want to take our audience on a shift with you or one of your colleagues on a rig, 911. You're called man down. You arrive at scene and it's, you know, an overdose and you give naloxone. And now what? What distinguishes what you do now compared to, okay, you're better, you want to come to the hospital or you want to sign out AMA? What should ideally happen now?
Yeah, no, I think that's a great question. I think it's super important to me because we had to rewrite that scripting completely. So let's take you, right? Let's take you down an alley. It's not a place that you'd ever be if you weren't where you'd hope to never be. There's always more people around than you, not always, but often than you expect. Depending on your town, there may be police. There's usually at least 4 EMS providers. And then your poor patient who you've been with for a few minutes while you were ventilating them, giving them naloxone, but who doesn't remember anything except using drugs and then waking up with you all staring. And so the old interaction used to be that they would come up. We would all be standing over the patient because we're getting old, my knees hurt, right? And the patient's laying there, all of us with our arms crossed, staring down. So like right away, that interaction is going to go great. In Camden, when that patient realizes they're there, they're quickly going to kind of understand that they overdosed. They're going to have this very uncomfortable nasal airway in their nose, and they're going to realize that almost certainly someone robbed them, right? They overdosed, they were left there, you know, whatever money they have to buy their next fix. And they're just going to start. And as they wake up and begin breathing, that overdose, that withdrawal begins, right? We've just had the iatrogenic induced withdrawal that naloxone causes. That thing that our patients with end-stage opioid use disorder spend almost 100% of their life avoiding is beginning. So that's the old interaction. That's that old scene. And it's why a lot of programs come to me like, what do you mean we're going to talk about buprenorphine? Like, this is that terrible scene. Like, we're lucky they don't assault us. They're going to curse at us. There's going to be this bad interaction. So we stepped back, and it's not perfect. We have about a 1 in 12 uptake on overdoses. So certainly we're not as successful as we need to be. But we brought that number down over time. And so we kind of re-scripted that whole model. So as soon as someone wakes up and begins to wake up, and you know, right, they, before they wake up, they start to take a few breaths, their pupils change. Right away, at that point, we can get that nasal airway out so they don't actually have to have it in there. It's miserable. You learn how to take it out nicely. We have a bottle of water and a towel because you're always covered in sweat and you're going to get more sweaty as you go into withdrawal, even if it's not hot. They're almost always parched, and it's just some, it's like, it's an olive branch. It's a cheap bottle of water, even though I hate plastic, the bottle of water, it's worth it here. And we get everybody out of the way, right? There's four or five people. We need one or two people, right? Usually one person per point and someone who can take it in case the interaction is going south. And then we kind of take a lot of time. One of the big things in EMS, police and fire is there's something I call it command authority, but somewhere I learned hidden that when, and in ER too, when things are going crazy, I need to raise my voice, project, and take control. And we need to kind of unlearn that piece here, right? This is not someone who needs to be yelled at. We don't need them to do something. We need to convince them to do something they don't necessarily want to do or haven't considered to do while they're not feeling well. So we got to change that interaction, and we give them some time. And so this is, I almost wish I could record it, but the HIPAA doesn't allow it. Right. And so the patient curses at me. They tell me, where's my phone? Where's my stash? All things that I often used to yell at someone right back. Hey, I was here to save you. How dare you disrespect me? All those things which are a visceral part of us. And we need to just put them aside, remind ourselves that we're not sick right now. And then it's all about the interaction, usually trying to talk about anything other than their overdose. Hey, how are you feeling? Are you okay? Which I know sounds a little touchy feely, especially for EMS, but it works. It's simple, right? Tell them what you know, not what you don't know, not what you assumed, but you know, hey, we found you, you weren't breathing. We gave you naloxone because we wanted to make sure you could breathe. I'm worried that you're going to go into withdrawal. It's very different than, hey, what did you use? And making it confrontational. A lot of times in this setting, our patients will refuse to be honest with us, which also often triggers a lot of things, right? I think somewhere I decided that my patients should see me as their priest and just tell me their whole life story, even though we just met, right? And so someone would be like, I don't use drugs. We never talk about that again, right? If you don't use drugs, that's, we can just talk. And so we start talking in vague terms. I'm like, hey, I don't know what happened before we got here. You know, person was already gone who called before you left. Usually helps them with what was stolen. And I say, hey, a lot of people we see, I always like to talk about hypotheticals. They're a lot less scary than talking about you yourself, right? A lot of people in your situation start to feel really sick with the amount of Narcan we gave you to wake up. I'm worried that you're going to go into withdrawal, even if they lied to me and said they don't use drugs, right? We're talking about all the people. And when sometimes they try and get up and leave. We used to like push you down or just yell at you and make you leave. Both of those practices needed to go away. But that's where, you know, give them the towel, the bottle of water, ask them if you can take a set of vital signs, tell them your boss is going to yell at you if you don't get the paperwork. And then, like I said, a lot of times I'm just having a bad day or you don't connect with people. And that's why my partner is right there. Right. And immediately when it looks like it's there, it just interrupts, change the attention. And I like bounce out. It's almost like you're in Top Gun and one pilot was out and the other pilot that it takes in. And usually just go back and forth. And after a few minutes, if you've been asking about, hey, how are you feeling? Are you sweaty? Look, you're yawning. Well, you know, you're really sweaty. Your heart's really fast. Are you thirsty? They start to realize, they know they're in withdrawal, right? Most of our patients have lived through this misery before, if not an overdose, just because they couldn't get their drugs. And then you start talking about the medication. And this is the second big piece of the cell, right? Most of our patients have tried buprenorphine. And a lot of patients have been made sick by it, right? If you take a low dose of buprenorphine, especially when you're not in withdrawal, you can precipitate withdrawal. And so we got to get past that, because the worst thing you can do is you've almost got a point where you could have a conversation and then you say you could give them some buprenorphine. They're like,
no, I don't want that stuff. That makes you sick.
Right. So I can remember the diarrhea and the vomiting, right? Like you can, and so you need to say right away, we had high dose buprenorphine, and talk about it. Like you're not trying, everyone, there's a lot of mistrust in this patient population, probably for very good reason. It's very different than the low dose products that you might've been given. It's going to blow you through any of those symptoms to get you better. We do this all the time, right? And luckily now after 5 years, we can say we've done this hundreds of times. And if you, once you get them on the hook, it's very easy then to start having the conversation, right? When you have all kinds of things, I need to make sure you weren't using methadone because it's not a win to put them on together. You know, if you used earlier today, you're going to be back on your methadone when the Narcan wears off. But that conversation is easy. Instead of it being antagonistic, right? Every time someone tries to leave, I'm like, hey, you could leave, but is there any way we could do this before you go, right? And try and give them some agency while we do it. And whenever we train a new service to do it, I try and invite someone to come into the city and ride with my people, because as much as I can talk about it, my medics are way better at this than I am. And it's great to watch when two of them really interact with this population.
Do you have to wait for that to be, because, you know, you want to be a little bit in withdrawal before you start the buprenorphine? Do you have to wait an hour? Like in the ED, sometimes we wait an hour at least.
No, so not what we found. So you have to be in withdrawal. That's definitely true. Like that doesn't, we've had horrible, not in the field, but in the ER, when we certainly tried this, we didn't always have the best results with some patients. But specifically with Narcan, almost always their withdrawal is escalating. So we require, in Camden, we just use 5. Other places have used 7 or 8 on the clinical opiate withdrawal scale, the CAOS score, as their threshold. And most of our patients that we treat are in the mid-range, usually 12 to 15 when they get the medication. But the biggest thing is we wait an hour. That's a ton of misery that patient has to go through. It's a lot of time for me to lose that conversation. So,
and you don't have that kind of time.
Right. We only increased our scene time by 7 minutes. There's no EMS service in the world that's going to allow me to keep their ambulances out for hours and hours. They're just too busy. Oh, right. It's just, I mean, it's the same thing when you try and sell this to an emergency physician. You're like, we're going to bring all the addiction patients. We're going to make you an addiction center of excellence. Aren't you excited? Like, it's just not the first thing that EM or EMS people went into medicine for, right? It's about blood and trauma. And so you have to convince them that we're doing good, but we're not going to destroy the system at the same time. So you're right. We only have minutes to make this conversation. And honestly, I think one of the things that makes post-overdose naloxone effective, I mean, buprenorphine effective, is that you have that moment. The patient can feel that crescendo of torture coming as they go into withdrawal. And so you're having that conversation and what you're saying is being backed up by their experience, right? Like, hey, are you nauseous? Well, even if they're not nauseous when I ask the question, often a few minutes later, yes, they are, right? And hey, you feel kind of sweaty? Do you feel like you have to go to the bathroom? Like maybe they don't when I ask them, but they shortly after will, because, right? And, you know, maybe I've only given them 2 milligrams, or maybe the police gave them 8 before I got there. And all of that is metabolizing while we sit together. And because buprenorphine sublingually doesn't, you know, it's not an instant medication, what I'm hoping to do is get it in there before your CAOS is too high, because that way you're not vomiting and that way you're not getting sick. And that 10 to 15 minutes it takes, I feel like those two are going to come together. And we've done over 300 patients. We had 2 who got precipitated because they were on methadone and we just didn't clear it the way we should have. And they did fine. But of all the other, you know, the other 300 or so patients, everyone had like a patient-centered CAOS score reduction and no one else precipitated, which was pretty amazing. We didn't expect it actually to be that good. So
you have these patients there. You have a patient. You completely changed your scene instead of like, hey, what'd you take? Instead of to, here's some water and here's a towel and are you nauseated? Right. And now you've convinced the patient to take buprenorphine. How much are you giving and what happens next? Like, okay, you helped one dose. What good is that?
Yeah, no, it's true, right? That's not, I mean, it's always nice to stop withdrawal, but I agree, like that's not the end of the road. So we give 16 milligrams, that's 2 strips. We use the strips because it seems to dissolve faster. I don't work for any of these companies. So if you're really strapped, Subutex is the generic, it's a little cheaper. But they're both, compared to the fancy meds we give in the ER all day, these are pretty cheap medications, especially for the 2 to 3 doses. we give 16, we always give ondansetron, Zofran, because first of all, vomiting, when they vomit, we lose the meds. When they vomit, I lose EMS because everyone hates vomit. So right, we usually give that right away. That's probably the first thing we offer is just either the injection or the sublingual, whatever they prefer. And then usually after we give the first dose, it's kind of transport decision time, right? Because like I said, there's another call somewhere in this, right? And the nice thing about it is if they go to the hospital, we can go right now, right? We've kind of done what we needed to do and we can move. But often, about half the time, at least in our system, they don't want to go. And so we are going to be committed to staying a little bit longer on scene this time. But because we don't actually have to drive anywhere and we don't have to wait for the triage nurse and just the amount of fact that there's no beds in most ERs, actually it saved those calls actually are less time for EMS than they also would have been. And then we wait somewhere between 7 and 10 minutes to see what the medication is doing. And we recheck a CAS score, right? To see if the patient's feeling better. If they are going down, then we stop as far as medication is concerned. But if they're about the same as they were 10 minutes ago or worse, then we give an additional 8 of them. And so the max is 24 milligrams. And then in that 10 minutes, we get, we do some vital signs, we do some conversation, and then we talk about the next steps and what are the options. So we're pretty blessed in our small system that I have a walk-in clinic that's open every afternoon, Monday through Friday. So depending on the day, they can go the same day or the next day, and they have priority in that clinic because we don't send a big population of patients. And so we talk about what services are there, what they can get. On the weekend, we really try to get them to go to the emergency department.
Can they get there? Do they have transportation, whatever, to get to this one clinic?
So it's not perfect. And by law, we can't drive them, which is a bummer. Again, and those are the hard things. In Camden, in our city, it's pretty small. So for most parts of the city, you can. There's actually a new service in the city called the Camden Loop, where there's like a free taxi that you can schedule rides with. But it's not perfect. And transport is a barrier for so many of my patients.
So your follow-up is go to this clinic that's available Monday through Friday, right?
Right.
But if it's a Saturday...
If it's a Friday or Saturday or Sunday, we really do try to get you to come to the emergency department. But if you're not willing to go, you do have 24 hours before you need it. And you can just walk into our emergency department. But you have to get there, too, and you have to wait. But we're pretty liberal. We will dose you for the weekend.
I just see a system where then you would now partner with a harm reduction coalition who then come at scene and kind of take it over from there from you. But also they would have telehealth on their iPad and they could write a prescription. They could, whatever, do this.
And so that's basically our program is 5 years old and the rest of the country in different places is moving with that. And so there's some telehealth options out there. A bunch of states have a pretty robust, like in the field, though I'm not sure most of those places are going to want to go to the Bandos in Camden. And then some places are using their community paramedics, either on the ambulance or who are separate from the ambulance to do those follow-up appointments, right? And so that's kind of the next step that we're exploring. New Jersey's been a little behind that side of EMS. They were, embracing the idea that paramedics could do more than just that A to B transport, right? Because I'd love to just say, hey, we're putting you on the roster for 7 days and do, kind of similar to the way we think of tuberculosis. We're going to directly observe you taking the medicine if you're willing for the next 7 days so we can get you into recovery. That's because I also work in addiction clinic now as part of some of my clinical time, though less and less, it's also too many barriers. But I really wanted to, if I was going to get the board certification, I needed to do it. And I wanted to be sure wasn't just a fake test I was taking.
Yeah.
And you see in the outpatient arena how hard it is seeing people once a week, every few weeks, or even longer intervals in some places to really get them stable, especially in those first few weeks to a month where, it's very easy to get fentanyl. No one in the pharmacy is going to fight with you. Your insurance isn't necessary. Like you do have to come up with the money, but the dealer is always right there. And so I love the idea of actually EMS, not even just bringing the social services and bringing the telehealth, which I'm all like to see the results of some of those. But I think the idea of, hey, for this number, I don't know what number of days it matters. Is it 5? Is it 7? Is it 20? Where we were there, not only to bring you the medication and lower that barrier for you, but see you do it. We don't need to get urines because we watched you put it in your mouth, right? And start looking at what those retention rates look like. So that is, I think, some of the next steps. But everyone, there's a lot of different little experiments going on as people figure out their own areas.
Yeah, I think that's great. You know what? You should make, I know you said it's HIPAA, you can't have a movie, but you should get some actors and do a little, it won't be a lot, and make a little movie. Like, this is what it used to be like. Hey, you overdosed. Like, what did you take? What did you, you know, ham that up, and then do your kind, gentler, get the patient to buprenorphine and follow up video. I think that, and if you do that, I want a copy so I could share it with our in our little circle.
I've been trying to suck my paramedics into making it for a while. I may have to dress up my EMS fellows because I'm not sure my paramedics are willing to be on TV, but maybe I can torture my fellows to do it.
The fellows
should
do it.
I'd love to get a few medics who want to role play because they really are so good.
You'll get a nurse or somebody to play patient. There's always some ham ER.
True.
That's awesome. All right. Well, that's great. So that's a great example. What things were used to be like, what's standard of care, what's not cutting edge, but what we should be thinking about doing. And you think about other creative solutions in general. What's next?
I think one of the other things that people are really doing, I think there's two, like the three models that I'm excited about for EMS in this space is one, what can we do right then? And I think that's buprenorphine. What can we do in the days following? And then how can we get you somewhere better, right? The reality is I love the ED bridge programs we've built, but I don't really believe most emergency departments, especially most emergency departments centered where the opiate crisis is just not able to be ignored, are ever going to be the perfect location for this. Like, my ER is just too busy. I just see too many patients in the shift to really spend the time I want to make a difference for these people. And so I know parts of California have these. I know a few places down south where you have these alternative destinations, both for mental health and for addiction, right? Because what I would love to see in Camden is in other places like it, but we had a place where, hey, you overdosed, your sugar is fine, you know, a paramedic has screened you, we can take you to a center, there'll be a nurse there, hopefully, or some kind of provider. But more importantly, there's going to be someone who can get you housing, food, identification. If you had it, it was probably just stolen. You can't do anything in life in this country if you don't have a driver's license or some kind of state ID. And so I think that's this amazing thing that EMS could, right? This idea that we can take you where you actually need to go.
I love how you're thinking, because I agree with you. We're the emergency department. We fix things, right? Whether it's your broken bones or a car accident, or fix society's problems. Like, we have a drug crisis. So I feel like the ED bridge program is a bridge for the patient, but also bridge for society. Like, okay, we got a national crisis. The emergency department is going to step in and help with this crisis. But that's not the end all, right? The point is the emergency department is not the best place to go to if you have a substance use disorder, a mental health problem, or homelessness. You know, we'll do it because we fix society's problems, and that's what we do. But in the meantime, we need to think long-term. This is not a solution to bring all these patients to the emergency department. It's not the best place for them. We need to have other resources, and whether it's centers or EMS involved or whatever, or frankly, now that we don't have the X waiver, every clinic in America should be able to do this. It's not just a specialty for emergency medicine. Any doctor's office should be able to do that, just like they treat diabetes or high blood pressure. I like how you're thinking. Like, well, we'll fix whatever's broken in society. That's what we do. But long term, I don't think that's not the solution. It's bad for the heart attack patient in the waiting room who can't get in, you know, because the beds are full of people who are homeless and don't have shelter and substance use and mental health. And because we're taking care of all of society's problems, we're not getting to other emergencies.
No, and I think you said it well. Like, if we're going to solve society, or we're going to step in for each thing, whether it's COVID, whether whatever the next thing is, that's our job.
Yeah.
Someone needs to be taking the last thing and solving it, so we're not overwhelmed for the next one, whatever it is going to be.
Right. Right. And we're kind of.
And I think that's a better sale to our people. I mean, the other thing is, I remember 7 years ago when I first started when I got my X waiver and all that, and. And to be honest, it wasn't something I was interested in doing. Like, I was not against it, but I wasn't for it.
Right.
And it, like, you know, it was another one of those things.
It was like, something else,
another night I'm going to lose. Right. And I know that's how some of my colleagues feel. And I get it. I think if we want the emergency services, provider population, both in the field, in the hospital, we have to tell them that this is a short term thing, that we're asking them to get into this space to help because that's what we do. But that someone is going to, there's relief coming.
Yeah. And I don't know that we can do that. But what we can do as emergency physicians, because it takes a while for society to understand. I've been around, 30 years. It takes a while. Like, we see the problem. We sound the alarm. And it could be, 5-10 years where it's like, oh, yeah, we have a problem with psychiatric patients in the emergency department. It's like, yeah, I've been saying that for 10 years. Right? But we have to keep at it. We're holding up the dam, but somebody else has to do that. But we have to be part of that in asking for that. I don't think I could promise my ER colleagues that, we have a solution coming up. We don't. We have to emphasize the problem. Solution. Right.
But I think if someone were working on it, it would make a lot of my colleagues happier. But me too. Because the mental health thing, I don't have a lot. I always say I'm not happy with the status quo, but I don't have a lot of great solutions. But we need to figure it out because since COVID, it's a huge problem for us. And what I don't understand here in New Jersey, you and I both know that mental health problems and substance use have huge amounts of overlap. And yet the number of psychiatric inpatient beds that do both that and substance use are vanishingly small. When a psychiatrist comes and sees my patient and says they're a dual diagnosis patient, which we all agree, I know now that my poor patient who's decompensated is going to be with me for God knows how many days. I can't think of anywhere worse to be decompensated psychiatrically than in the emergency department for days on end.
I think the for mental health, I would, I'm not a mental health, I'm an emergency physician. But as an ER doctor these days, I feel like I am pretty much a psychiatrist because that's all I'm seeing in the emergency department. But the same principle of you have to take the patients who have a real problem, right? They're in your emergency department. We don't have beds. We need beds. We need facilities. But you can't just keep building beds without thinking upstream, right? If I had to do one thing to decrease mental health issues in our country, and you'll laugh, but I would say just data-wise, if I could convince men between the age of 20 to 30 not to use marijuana, we would have 30% less schizophrenia in our country. And this is based on large population studies of 7 million people in Denmark. Huge, things. We have to think upstream and, life resiliencies and, mental health. I went to my granddaughter's preschool, 2-year-old, and they did a little birthday party. And on the wall, they had what to do if you're stressed out. 2-year-olds, take a breath, walk around, I'm thinking this is great, great resiliency for 2-year-olds. We need to continue this.
That's not kind a bad of idea.
Life skills, throughout.
It'd be interesting to see. I mean, marijuana is just going officially legal here, though it's been fairly prevalent for a lot, even it was legalized a few years back, but we'll see. I mean, those associations with schizophrenia are scary. I don't know yet what's going to happen there, but even now, that's a whole new world. The ER needs some more space, right? We keep having small mass casualty incidents where someone brought, an 8-year-old brought gummies to school and there's all these kids high. The marijuana thing is going to be an interesting challenge. But
actually, if you don't mind, let's talk a little bit about that because that's fun and maybe I could convince you of things. But, there was a study that just came out about heart attack risk. I think the odds ratio for you having a heart attack, coronary artery disease, or stroke is up to 3 odds ratio, 3 times higher, 300% higher if you use cannabis, unrelated to tobacco smoke, right? So, I mean,
really?
Yeah.
Read that. That's pretty fascinating.
And this is from the American Heart Association. So, every single shift, you and your colleagues treat cannabis poisonings. And I just think it's we're not recognizing that. Just like 20 years ago, we didn't recognize all the opioid overprescribing that we were doing. And so we're seeing that in mental health. We obviously see that with the cannabis hyperemesis syndrome, right? Soft
That's
belly.
Torture.
Right. It torture. But there are ways, just like how you changed your script, in talking with the overdose patients, that I have a water and are you nauseated? I'm going to try to help you. I've changed my script with the cannabis hyperemesis syndrome. And all that cannabis type of, I don't know how many stroke codes you've ran where the MRI, CT, everything's normal. And then only later you find out, well, this is cannabis.
Oh, we haven't had that yet. But like I said, I think we were probably behind, the West is definitely was ahead of this. I mean, we have plenty of marijuana, but the amount of marijuana that some of my patients are now taking is, I think, incredibly higher than what I'd ever seen before.
And the potency. And what we're failing at, like, we'll have a patient in the ER, like 19-year-old, pacing around, talking to himself, you know, clearly psychotic, and we'll go, okay, this patient needs a mental health evaluation. We'll move on to the next patient, right? And this was like, you know, so then I go in as the attending and reevaluate the patient. It's like, and I ask, okay, well, what are you using? It's like, well, what kind of marijuana are you using? It's like, and he was using waxes. It's like, if I take this 19-year-old kid and let him understand what happened to you, do you understand what happened to you? Right. That's very different. Like, well, you're crazy. You shouldn't use drugs or you shouldn't use pot. Right. And that's like, oh, I'm so sick of all this pot. Right. That's our ER. Instead of like, do you understand what happened to you? And this association of you hearing these voices of your father, you know, about to kill your brother and seeing these bags of blood, or then if they can make that association, you could potentially prevent that kid from becoming have chronic schizophrenia. If this was only the first or second psychotic episode, now you have potential, right, in preventing a long-term disease. And I see a lot of our colleagues just kind of blowing it off. It's like, it's just weed. But we're not making that prevention intervention that could affect someone's life long-term.
No, I mean, in general, I think motivation, like, you always think of motivational interviewing as this big, like, thing, you know, psychiatry, you might spend months and months of your curriculum on it.
Right.
It doesn't take a lot of time. To be an expert, I'm sure it takes a ton of time, but to change just a little bit of how you do things and talk to people, I think one of the best thing, like whatever I decide to do with my addiction board and the training I've got in this, it's that I just do better with my patients in general since I did it, which seems so cheesy, but I thought I was an excellent physician. Of course you would, right? But I wonder how many of my patients were doing anything I asked them to do before I really thought about how I was talking to them.
Right.
So I think that part of it is huge. And so whether it's a brief intervention for marijuana, for opiates, for anything, I think somewhere I was taught a lot about lecturing people. And I know how well that works with my teenager. So I definitely it's working with most. So
it's hard, not to do, because that's what we do for a living and what we've done for 20, 30 years. It's hard to change that. And I do think that there's a role for us as a doctor to say, well, hey, this is what happened to you. But to get you to change your behavior, you're right, takes a little bit. The other trick, I'll just send you this, because I know now that after we talked, you're going to go to your shifts and you're going to see all these things. You look for your stroke, your negative stroke coat workup. I think the thing is we just don't ask, but I'll have, like I had a guy who came in with a GI bleed 3 times and he was a, you know, chronic marijuana user goes, I've been using, you know, I'm a product of the 70s. I'm always using that. It's like, okay, but now you're on Plavix and that interacts with your cannabis that you're using, right? So one of the things that I do is I have my adult patients who take medications and they say, oh, well, I just use a little bit for sleep or I just use it for my pain. And I'll just have them go to drugs.com and check their drug interaction checker and check for themselves. Right, so I had to, you know, and I have, I've had patients where they're a little dizzy or weak and they don't know. And then they'll read for them symptoms and they're like, oh, my God. All right. I don't need the lab work. I'm good. I understand. So that's a good trick for older patients who are taking medications for them to read for themselves what's happening to them.
No, it is true. I think as people are less and less willing to just trust us, and maybe that's just a sign, whether we like it or not, that is the way it's going. We're going to have to give people more agency to figure out how they're going to make their own decisions. Yeah. That is a good idea. You can look it up here. You can look it there. Better than where you might go look it up, too.
And then I'm wondering if Camden's a little different in, you know, drugs. Like you mentioned, you have more PCP. I've seen it, but not often. I have patients that come in. They woke up from naloxone. They clearly had a fentanyl overdose. They test positive for fentanyl. By the way, I don't know if you guys have fentanyl testing in your ear yet. I could pitch you on that. And they say, I don't, like you said, I don't use drugs. And they do not meet the criteria for opiate use disorder. And I would say, in my estimation, that happens to me half the time, where they meant to take meth. Their drug of choice is meth. Their drug of choice was, you know, he swore he was only vaping, or they just used a bong. And they could be lying to me, but they from what they're saying to me, they don't meet the criteria for opiate use disorder for me to do buprenorphine. I don't know how often you run into that.
So it's kind of interesting. I mean, our two big drugs, the opiates are probably our biggest drug of use. And then crack cocaine is number two for us. And they're very close. Beyond that, then alcohol is three, and then meth is very small for us, but PCP is significant. PCP is a different kind of addiction, obviously, right? It's not a withdrawal kind of addiction. Mm-hmm. But we have a huge population, and it's a very disruptive population, right? People who do PCP and end up in the ED are having a bad trip. It's a mess.
Yeah.
But we do have a population who uses a lot of crack cocaine, who then overdoses because of like cross-contamination with the fentanyl. And that's what we're getting. Who knows for sure, but that makes the most sense.
Yeah.
And so it's hard to know. I have a number of those patients who I see in clinic who are primarily cocaine users. They also now have an opiate use disorder, or they started with cocaine and now they have an opiate use disorder because of the contamination. Because, you know, you can get cocaine washout, but right. They're going into withdrawal every day because I think there was enough fentanyl in their crack. Mm-hmm. They have a problem with both now. But no, we certainly have some population, especially patients who have fallen, their life hasn't completely unraveled and they have access to maybe a slightly better drug supply, who are, then getting into it and overdosing. And no, I agree. Like, you can't give it to all of them. And usually you can see, right, they don't go into withdrawal like the rest of our other, like our opiate use patients do.
Yeah, interesting.
But it is interesting how fentanyl seems to be everywhere. And the xylazine problem is our newest torture. Thought we were just getting a foothold here, and now that's completely unraveling a lot of what we were accomplishing. I don't know how much you have of that, but it's basically all of our drug supply
Not like you. Very, very small. And our medical examiner, we speak to him every month to see if it's hit us. We've had deaths that have xylazine in them, but very few, like five. Not at the doses that you have on the East Coast. And all of them, 100% of them, they had fentanyl or carfentanil or something else.
Yeah, I mean, they're still mostly responding. I mean, we have some who are now more like they fully regain capacity after they're reversed. But the wound care is changing everything. I mean, where it used to all be, not that spinal epidural abscesses and endocarditis weren't enough of a problem, but tranq wounds are,
they're bad.
It's really ridiculous. Yeah. It's like zombies. It's awful. We've had amputations. We've had all kinds of craziness.
That's terrible. Dr. Gerard Carroll, thank you so much for what you do. And really, you are in the forefront of EMS and probably the leader in our nation in getting us to think of pre-hospital care and the role in addiction and the role in society and going beyond just a trip to, a taxi ride to the hospital. So I really enjoy this opportunity to be able to talk to you and think and about different models and how we could be better and not being happy with the status quo together with you.
Awesome. No, this is a super fun way to spend the afternoon. I hope to talk again soon.
All right. Great. Thank you. Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to FAF, Families Against Fentanyl. Visit familiesagainstfentanyl.org to learn more. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I am your host, Dr. Ronit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.